Session number 26589, Hugh Grant Dalton, Reel 2.
We're fine.
Is that okay?
Yep. Oh, yes.
Nine trips, I see a second pilot. Two of them were aborted, actually, so they didn't count. Just early return. I don't know what it was that might say something. I didn't make many comments in my logbook as such. One thing was an engine trouble. Two engine troubles. Early return.
Right. Two out of nine. Was that a normal ratio to have mechanical or engineering engine problems?
Oh, I think it's one of those things that varied, actually. No, I think it's just one of those things.
It just seems to be, it's difficult enough to fly a Hamden to the centre of Germany and back again.
Mm.
Hostile sky and with uncertain engines.
Of course, one thing about the Hamden is that, as with Wellington 1C, they had the same engine, Pegasus 18. You couldn't feather. So they were not very good on one engine. If you could feather, if you lost your prop, you were okay.
If it came off?
You couldn't feather it.
And feather means you can turn it so that its wind resistance is very limited.
That's right, and it doesn't rotate or anything.
So it acts as a so an unfeathered propeller is acts as a great drag.
Yeah, that's right.
Which will presumably pull the aircraft round to that side all the time, or not?
Well, it would tend to anyway. You could trim that out, but it just hasn't got the power in the other engine
to fly on one engine.
No. Yes, I see. I see. We had a radio failure on one of them. Now, the first trips I did was with the flight commander on 50, which meant that I was sort of hanging around, didn't go out every single night. Now, I did three more trips down here with somebody called Pio Christophers. And strange to relate, not so very long ago, it's 15 years, 20 years ago, anyway. I heard from him from New Zealand.
You heard from Pilot Officer Christopher?
Yes. I'm afraid he's no longer with us. Now, this is because I'd been in contact with somebody else in New Zealand, and he heard about me. A small world, voices from the past, and all that sort of thing.
Yes. Those nine operations that you did, one knows of the terrible losses the Bomber Command suffered generally, but were the losses high at this stage before? In other words, what I'm really asking is, were German night defences as effective then in 1941 as they later became, or were there differences between operating in April 1941, as you are, or in the mid-1941, and, say, in early 1944, which is where we will eventually arrive at?
Well, the chop rate was very much higher later on.
It was it?
Oh, it was. As far as I can remember, the defences over Germany, they didn't worry much about fighters at night. There was a searchlight belt, which was just about on the Dutch border. There was another belt of searchlights, it used to be just the other side of Hanover, to protect Berlin. There was flak, of course, at all the major targets to cope with. Now, I seem to remember sort of bombing heights, as far as that goes, somewhere around about 12,000 feet.
So you'd be vulnerable to accurate flak, wouldn't you, at 12,000 feet?
Yeah.
But not many night fighters floating around.
No. Of course, in those days, now navigation, it was hit, very much a case of hit or miss. Because there were no aids as such. G hadn't come in. You had to rely on just straightforward DR, occasional radio bearings, and just visual pinpoints. Mind you, we went out on moonlight nights and at that time, so when there's water around, you could see. You get a reasonable pinpoint anyway, on the Rhine or on coastal targets like Bremen or Hamburg and Kiel. But I'm afraid an awful lot of people used to just bomb on ETA.
And that could be anywhere.
Could be anywhere. I know. They say within 10 miles or something. I don't know. No, I'm afraid bombing was not at all accurate then. But so, where are we?
Well, you're doing your 9 operations with 50 Squadron.
Oh, yes. Well, having completed that, we went to Brest, I see. We were having a go at the Scharnhorst and Eisenhower then. Went more than once.
And when would that be, in 1941?
May. Yes, including gardening. See, gardening Vangaroo, which is off the Frise in summer. Brest gardening. We were going to a place called Zeist, supposed to be, and we bombed Essen instead. Anyway, after those trips, I went on to, where are we? Cottesmore to 14 OTU. Where I started doing more training, including night flying on the Hamlin to get up to first class, captain standard. That was there for about a month, I think. During that time, 50 had moved from Lindholm to Swinderby, because they were putting in runways at Lindholm at that time. And then, so we operated out of Swinderby.
Which is in Lincolnshire, I think?
Lincolnshire. It's on the Fosway, halfway between York and Lincoln.
Yes.
It had a satellite at Skellingthorpe. And then they started put in runways at Swinderby, so we moved over to Skellingthorpe, but we used to shuttle between the two. Skellingthorpe's just outside England,
yes.
A bit nearer.
Yes. This is unusual. Was it unusual to do a total of 10 operations, 9 at with 50 Squadron and 1 at your misposting, and then come off operations to continue training? Was that the norm at that time?
That was the norm on Hamlin's, yes.
It was.
Go back and do some training, night flying, that sort of thing. Then go back again to the squadron. That was quite normal. We all did it.
And operations at that, a tour at that time was still 30?
30 trips or 200 hours. They mentioned hours, actually, at that stage. So on my first tour, I actually did 29 trips.
Because you'd reached 200?
Well, they decided I'd had enough of what I
was
about. Right. I didn't actually add it up. Anyway, I actually did 29. But I remember the gardening ones. I remember particularly one. Where we went up to Wick, operated out of Wick on the
So you went up to the absolute top of Scotland.
Yes, went up there and we went up to gardening in Oslo Field. It hadn't got the range tree to go up from Lincolnshire.
Yes. So you flew from Wick.
So we flew from Wick.
Did gardening operations count as a full operation?
Oh, no, yes.
They did?
Oh, yes. Because the mine laying was done below 1,000 feet. 800 to 1,000 feet.
Did it drop out on a parachute or just go straight in the water?
I can't remember, actually. I think it went straight in the water from that time. Because we didn't fly very fast anyway in those days.
What sort of speed did a Hamlin go at?
I can't remember cruising speeds now.
Right. One could, in a way, work it out in the distance that you flew to Hamburg and back, and it took you 6¾ hours.
It took me, and well, you know better on this one probably, we went to Berlin and back, 8:45.
A long, long time.
Landed at Church Fenton. I missed a recall, actually. But they recalled because of fog. I meant to get
down. Oh, so your aircraft was recalled, or the whole force was recalled?
The whole force was recalled.
So you carried on to Berlin on your own?
Well, there must have been a few others. I mean, we missed the recall. I was way up. I must have been way beyond Magdeburg, I think, when it came through.
And you were recalled because there was fog back in the UK?
Yeah.
And therefore you wouldn't be able to land, or...?
We didn't land at Swinderby. We landed at Church Fenton, which is... it's in Yorkshire anyways.
And in order, presumably, I mean, Hugh, you must explain this. This is, would it not be as difficult to find Church Fenton as it was to find Berlin? Therefore, how did you get at night without proper navigational aids, as we would understand it today, an airfield like Church Fenton? How would you do it?
I think if you've got the River Ouse there, you can see, you can get pinpoints on. We had flashing, every airfield had its own flashing red beacon, and we carried those on this piece of rice paper, as well as the signals for the day. So that would have helped.
But in other words, there were no radio directional beacons, so you could guide yourself into an, or be guided into an airfield.
You could get a radio fix. As I can remember,
which will tell
and
you.
And there were other means of identifying yourself, of getting down. There was some on RTE. There was something called Darkey. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't. No, what is that?
You called up Darkey, and if you were lost, and you flew around the circle, and searchlights were supposed to come on, like level, point you to an airfield.
Right. Sounds a bit hit and miss, but...
it was. It used to work. Used to hear occasions of people calling up, hello, Darkie, you little black bastard. Which I don't think is not quite correct these days. Anyway, to go back to Wick, it was that Osno one. It was full moon. Came in over the city, down to about 800 feet, and dropped our mine. Somebody fired down us on a hit from a hill on the port side, and I remember flying a bit further down the fjord. We saw some lights on the starboard side, which thought, there must be something. I mean, we were used to carry 250 pounds, and we could drop it on anything we liked, what we thought might be a target. We dropped our bombs on those lights and came in.
But unfortunately, they could easily have been Norwegian civilian lights.
I don't think they would have been. They wouldn't have had full lights on.
They wouldn't.
Bright lights.
I'm surprised.
Sort of flood, almost flood lights. As far as I can remember.
Right. So there was an element of discretion available to crews.
There was when you were gardening, yes. You could drop your bombs on it, or what you thought might be a suitable target.
It sounds as if that Oslo and its fjord was relatively undefended.
There wasn't much opposition there, no. Brilliant moonlight, right? Bright cloud. Clouds and everything. I always remember that one.
And no fighters.
No fighters. That was a different story when we went up to Norway later on.
Well, we'll come to that.
It's another story.
It's another story. So after you finished your night training, And you are now a fully qualified, how shall I call it, first pilot or captain?
Yeah, first pilot.
Yeah. First pilot. We're now at the end of 1941.
Yeah.
Where did you go and what happened?
Well, I'll tell you something else on the 50th. Have you been watching the, they showed it again on Sunday, the SAS programme?
No, I didn't see it, I'm afraid, no.
It was a repeat, actually. They showed the Barks Array.
Oh, the commandos, yes.
Commandos, yes.
Yes, I did see it.
Well, half of 50 went on that.
And were you flying that day?
I was, but I went gardening in Kiel.
So you were the other half of the squadron?
Yeah, I was
you
on went, the other half of the squadron.
You went over to Kiel?
Yep. I see I went up to Wick for some reason, or about a week before.
And you'd have flown to Kiel from Wick as well?
No, from no. I say we went just went up to Wick and back again.
Right.
But must have been taking somebody up or something. I don't know. See, I just write the brief entry of what details were. If I landed somewhere different, but some people used to write it sort of a full history in their logbooks.
But you never found that necessary.
Well, I didn't. I never started it. I never kept it up. I mean, it's just a straight entry all the way through. Now, my final trip on the Hamblin there was, let's have this page. January 26, 1942, to Hanover. Yes, that's right.
Is it 6 1/4 hours? No, six hours 25.
6:25.
6 hours 25 minutes to Hanover and back.
I seem to remember that was a moonlight night. I do vaguely remember that one. There was a lot of snow and stuff on the ground, I could see.
And again, the defences would not be as they were later in the war?
After that was my last trip, 29.
That was your last trip to Hanover then?
On that tour. Oh, I see, I've got some total of hours, 197.10. First tour, as far as that goes.
So, would morale have been quite high?
It was very high then.
On these squadrons, it was,
yes.
Was it?
I see from various letters, too, that I wrote home, we seem to have a whale of a time, actually, on the squadron. You mentioned mess parties. I remember going into a theatre in Lincoln one night with a party of us. I think it was a variety show of some sort. Anyway, we ended up in the box, and there was the people on stage sort of pointed us out and made jokes. Is quite fun. Mind what? You, I'll tell you one thing. I went through the war, and I never smoked, and I never started. And I've never smoked since. No. Which I think is a good thing. And I hardly ever drank. A lot of people used to get pissed.
Did they?
Oh, yes. They used to go into Lincoln to the what was known as the Snake Pit. You heard of the Snake Pit?
No.
Thousands
no.
Arms. Known as the Snake Pit. I didn't join in.
Just from personal preference, really?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Mind you, as far as the crews are concerned, we didn't stay together as a crew very long, you see, because they were always changing. And,
So, you're showing me at the moment, Hugh, pictures of your four crew, the Hamden in the background, which carries your family crest, you tell me.
Yeah.
And one of the pictures has the four ground crew standing behind the Hamden.
I'm afraid I don't know their names. I haven't got any record. I didn't write them down.
But the first gentleman here, who is a sergeant?
Sergeant, yes. Sergeant Kilduff. They were both WAP AGs, wireless operator gunners.
And he survived a tour.
I think so.
And then is your good self.
Yes.
And then the two gentlemen on the left, the first man is, you tell me, is a pilot officer?
Roblin.
Yes.
And the other one is Sergeant Beatty. And they were both lost about a couple of months after I left the squadron.
On active operations over Germany?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I can tell you where, if I can... I've got the book over here somewhere, if I can find it.
So Hugh, we're now looking for the details when these two gentlemen were lost.
Yes, there we are.
Oh, shot down by a night fighter off Vleeland. Pilot Officer Roblin, Sergeant Thompson, Sergeant Beatty and Sergeant Howarth all missing. And that is the 25th, 26th of March, 1942.
That's right.
Vleeland is that Denmark?
That sounds like one of the Frisians.
Frisians, is it?
Yeah, one of the Frisian islands, I think.
Okay. So, one of the things I didn't realise here is that crews mixed and matched and would come and go during a course of a tour of operations.
Oh,
so you therefore flew with quite a number of different people in your first 29 operations.
Oh yes, very much so.
And there was no difficulty with becoming a fully operational crew together? You managed to mix in well without any difficulty?
Yes, as far as I can remember, we all trained to much the same standard, you see. So that we could fit in.
Yes. But you didn't mess with the crew. I mean, I know that two of you are pilot officers and two are sergeants, but you didn't mess or with the crew or socialise?
Certainly not on camp. I know some crews used to meet up in Lincoln and that sort of thing, but I didn't.
Did you tend to lead a solitary path?
I suppose so. I don't know. Didn't strike me as that at the time. One thing I always was keen on before the war was music. I used to try and hear as much classical music as I could on the station. I can remember the Christmas Eve 1941 hearing the King's College Choir lessons and carols being broadcast.
Live from
King's.
Cambridge.
Yeah.
Yep.
I remember hearing that. But I see, I remember trying to hear concerts on the Miss Wireless. I say Wireless, he because it was Wireless in those days.
Yes.
We talk about radiograms, but Wireless.
But you met some resistance listening to concerts on the Miss Wireless, did you?
Well, I tried to.
This would have been the third programme.
Third programme hadn't been invented.
Oh, it hadn't?
No, that wasn't invented until after the war.
I didn't realise that.
1940s.
So this would be the Home Service then?
Home Service. There were only two programmes. There was the Home Service and the Horses programme.
So the Light programme didn't exist either?
No. The Light programme took over from the Horses programme.
Ah. So with only two... Your colleagues in the mess preferred the Forces station channel.
Yeah, well, I tried to... it was only when the mess was quiet, you see, it was to do that. There weren't too many complaints, as far as I can remember. But I see on other occasions, later on, anyway, they used to have SEMA concerts and records. We used to borrow records, I think, and that sort of thing.
After you, presumably you had, before we go on to what you did after you finished your first tour, you had leaves every six operations, every 10 every 6 weeks, every 10 operations. What sort of period?
Well, the official leave was Once every 3 months, I think. Well, you've got railway warrants. But squadrons, I know later on, they used to have, you had a week off every 6 weeks. Certainly when I got to 100 later on. I see from the letters home that I quite often comment on when I'm going to get time off.
How did you spend your leaves?
I usually went home.
Did you? And had 7 or 14 days with your parents?
Only a week.
A week?
Yes, it's only a week. Not 14 days. I remember we used to... Well, Eastbourne, of course, suffered badly from the Tip and Run raids. A lot of bomb damage. We were lucky in our house. Incidentally, I should go back to the beginning. The father was an air raid warden at the beginning of the war, and our house was an ARP post. And then, a bit later on, he joined the Home Guard. He was number 2 Eastbourne Home Guard.
At what age would he have been at this time?
I was born in 1889. Worked that one out.
Right.
Yes. Where were we?
Well, where we
I'm
were...
I'm just finishing my first tour.
You're later. Just finishing your first tour, and I am just going to ask you before we move on, which we can use to really to finish this tape up with, is before we do move on and you leave the squadron at the end of your first tour, whether there is anything that you would, anything that stands out or anything that you would like to mention that we haven't touched on?
I don't think there is, actually.
There isn't. Okay. And we have just spent a moment looking at your family albums. You made an interesting comment there when the tape was off, but I would like to just touch on it now, where you and your sister have lived together here for now 45 years in this yeah. lovely house in Limpstone. And you did say to me that you were quite put off the possibility of marriage at one point by seeing so many people find girlfriends and then get lost over Germany.
Yes, not only finding them, but marrying too. And then they promptly got the job. I know you read various accounts of people being superstitious and all that sort of thing. But that's, I might say that's about the only thing as far as I'm concerned. I knew several girls in Eastbourne, of course. In the younger days, but somebody else got them first, got in there first. The other course was a neighbour was, well, I might have considered, I suppose, but she was an RC, and I put that right out.
Because you're not of a religious persuasion, or?
No, because I'm Church of England. Mind you, I don't do much these days.
Yes, and I think that in those days, certainly Catholics like to have their children brought up as Catholics.
Definitely, yeah.
Maybe slightly more relaxed today, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. No, that's the only one. I can think of one who got married and just the end of the war. She got married or just after. But, as far as girls are concerned, no. Put me off completely, the chopper. It's about the only thing I can say about that.
Thank you, Hugh. We'll end this tape here because we're almost at the end, and we'll start a second tape with you leaving the squadron at the end of your tour.
Mm-hmm.